Welcome to How to Save Your Life. How to Save Your Life is produced with the assistance of the Department of Neurological Surgery, Weill Cornell Medical College, New York Presbyterian Hospital. Your host is Dr. Philip Stieg, Chairman of the Department of Neurological Surgery and Neurosurgeon-in-Chief at New York Presbyterian Hospital.
Welcome to How to Save Your Life. We turn our attention this week to the topic of cancer and how it affects the brain and spine. Dr. Orlando Del Maestro, widely considered to be one of the best neurosurgeons in North America, shares his expertise on topics including early detection, treatment, and the future of brain cancer treatment. That and more coming up on How to Save Your Life.
Welcome. This is Dr. Philip E. Stieg, Professor and Chairman of the Department of Neurological Surgery at the Weill Medical College of Cornell University and Neurosurgeon-in-Chief at New York Presbyterian Hospital, and I'd like to welcome you to How to Save Your Life. This week, it's my distinct pleasure to introduce to you Dr. Orlando Del Maestro, Professor of the Department of Neurology and Neurosurgery and Professor of the Department of Neuro-Oncology. He is the William Findell Chair in Neuro-Oncology at McGill University in Montreal, Canada. He is the Director of the Montreal Neurological Institute's Brain Tumor Research Center. He is on the Board of Directors of the Canadian Brain Tumor Consortium, the National Cancer Institute of Canada, and the Brain Tumor Foundation of Canada. He's published over 100 articles in refereed journals. He lectures both nationally and internationally. In addition to this, he's had time to become an expert and collect the works on Leonardo da Vinci. Hopefully we'll have time to get into each one of these things, but Orlando, it's a delight to have you here with us today.
It's my pleasure and honor to be here.
Perhaps you could explain for the listeners what a neuro-oncologist does.
Well, neuro-oncology is an interesting subspecialty. It really revolves around both the area of neurology, which is really the brain and the spinal cord and the nerves of the body, and the area of oncology, which is cancer that may involve those areas. Now, the tumors that involve those areas could be either benign tumors, which we really are considered to be tumors that stay in one place, or they can be more aggressive tumors, which are malignant, which grow more quickly. So in essence, what a neuro-oncologist does is he takes care of patients that have diseases of the central and peripheral nervous system that are involved with either benign or malignant tumors. They can be either directly, or sometimes it can be associated with certain tumors can cause secondary problems involving that part of the body.
And when you refer to the central nervous system, you mean both the brain and the spine and spinal cord.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, how common of a problem is this? And I'd like to frame it in this perspective of lung, breast, and prostate cancer, the big worries.
There is about 30,000 primary brain tumors in North America, being really Canada and the United States, per year. And they are tumors that actually start in the brain or start in the spinal cord. However, there's somewhere around 150 to 200,000 secondary brain tumors, or these are tumors that have, let's say, arisen in the breast or the kidney or the lung and have spread to the central nervous system, the spinal cord, or the brain. And when you put that all together, that's a large number of tumors that we have to deal with. At the present time, there is, you know, somewhere around those numbers of primary and breast cancer and somewhere around those numbers of primary lung cancer. So the essence of it is that when you put everything together, despite the fact that, you know, the brain tumors are not so common, the consequences of cancer and the brain are. Brain tumors are the most common malignant tumor that's solid of children, so that's a major problem. I don't think people realize how important tumors are in the pediatric sort of population. And brain tumors are the second or third most common tumor, let's say, in the 20 to sort of 40 age group. So they're a fairly common tumor in those sort of ages.
So when we listen to, you know, many of the pop shows on TV and their concerns about the other forms of cancer, I think that there needs to be more alarm, or do you agree that there needs to be more alarm about their impact both on the brain and also primary tumors or tumors that originate in the brain.
The big thing, if you think about it in children, for example, if malignant brain tumors being the most common cause of death from cancer in the pediatric age group, now it really means that, you know, if a child dies at a young age from a brain tumor, then a large amount of life is lost. Many other tumors occur in relatively older individuals, so the amount of life loss associated with those tumors is quite a bit less. So at the present time, brain tumors are one of the highest types of tumors if one looks at the number of potential years that that individual may have to live. So I think that one has to sort of change the paradigm here a little bit from numbers, let's say numbers of prostate cancer or whatever that one sees, and look more carefully at the numbers of years that are actually lost to that particular cancer in our society.
And we'll get into this a little bit later in the show, but we'll talk more about the quality of life after a brain tumor versus the quality of life that one can have with lung cancer, breast cancer, and prostate cancer. I'm sure many people are wondering, do brain tumors affect women and men equally, or is there a different distribution?
There are some tumors that are much more common in females than they are in men. An example of that is a type of benign brain tumor that's called a meningioma, where some around 70% of those tumors affect women. And there are other tumors that have a tendency to affect males a little bit more. But overall, probably, if you look at the full numbers, there's not a big difference between the number of males or females that have primary brain tumors.
So all of us should be equally concerned. Are there risk factors that we should avoid, or are they primarily the risk factors related to the primary tumor that spreads to the brain?
Well, I think for the secondary tumors, clearly the most important risk factor is smoking. You know, lung cancer being the most common tumor that takes the lives of people in North America at the present time, then if one prevents smoking, one prevents the initial tumor, and therefore one prevents the secondary tumors that go to the brain. So I think that's an important sort of aspect of it, how important the prevention of smoking in our society and the decrease in that sort of number of individuals that are involved. I think that overall there are some syndromes that we know about, probably 2-3% of the cancers of the brain and of the spinal cord that are associated with familial incidents. One is neurofibromatosis type 1, there's neurofibromatosis type 2, there's a number of other disorders like that, but they make up a small amount of the total number. So overall, I think that one really can't do a great deal about primary brain tumors. One can be very vigilant in these familial disorders and should be very vigilant to make sure these particular people do not develop brain tumors. But for the normal situation, there's not anything one can do to prevent brain tumors. They are a random event. They don't generally occur in families, and unfortunately, there's nothing we know that can really prevent them.
Usually, I presume, when you see patients that have these tumors that have spread from some other part of their body, I presume that they must ask you, you know, why'd this happen? What do you tell them?
Well, what's interesting about the primary brain tumors is that they, generally speaking, in other words, if a tumor starts in the brain or the spinal cord, they almost never go to any other part of the body. Unfortunately, tumors that start in many other parts, like the lung or the breast or the kidney, etc., do have a tendency to go to the brain. At the present time, we have no way of preventing this phenomena from occurring. And if it does occur, a number of things happen. Number one is that most of those patients, unfortunately, are not going to do very well. And the reason for that is if the tumor is already spread to your brain, that let's say you have in the lung, it may be relatively straightforward to deal with a lung tumor, but dealing with the brain tumor may be much more difficult. The second thing is that for many of the new drugs that are coming along at the present time, if you have a brain tumor, those patients don't tend to be put in the trials because there are the feeling that, for example, the newer drugs that are coming for lung cancer, etc., if you have a brain tumor, that's going to make a lot of complications that you wouldn't necessarily have if you just had the lung tumor. So unfortunately, that means if you have a brain tumor, you're not eligible for many of these newer drugs and newer trials that are coming out, which is a disappointment. The other thing that, you know, there's about 400 drugs that people use for cancer at the present time. Only about 8 actually get into the nervous system. So that severely limits the chemotherapeutic approaches to brain tumors. And if you think about it, if a tumor is already spread to your brain, and let's say you have radiation therapy or chemotherapy, especially, you know, the combination of those two can sometimes have a lot of cognitive effects. And those effects can be long-lasting and not very pleasant for patients.
So I'm a patient out here listening to this show that's got lung cancer or breast cancer, and my doctor hasn't told me to get a head CT or an MRI scan. I mean, what do you recommend? Is there a screening protocol? Everybody, when during their cycle of the primary disease should they get a scan of their brain?
I think for some of the newer drugs that that people are on for, let's say, breast cancer, there is, in some of those protocols, people do have a CT scan of the brain just to make sure that they don't have a brain-related disease, because if they do, the possibility that that drug is going to be effective is not very high. And in certain types of lung cancer, especially small cell lung cancer, those patients have CT scans or MR scans of the brain, because if you have that problem, it has to be dealt with rather carefully, because again, most chemotherapies don't get into the brain, so that's going to be a long-term problem for you. But unfortunately, there's no real protocols at the present time to decide, for example, if you have carcinoma of the kidney, should you have a screening sort of CT scan of the head. What's happening now, however, and I've seen this more often, is that people are having PET scans now to identify the spread of their cancer, whether it's a cancer of a lung or the breast or the kidney or other areas. And a number of these tumors will pick up on the PET scan if they're involving the brain. So I think what will happen in the future is more and more PET scans are used, we'll identify more and more brain tumors at the same time that we identify the initial tumor. And that will be useful, because that will allow us to focus on the real disease that the patient has that is going to be damaging to them.
So do you think, actually, you know, you quoted a number of about 200,000 tumors spreading to the brain in North America. You think that number is actually going to be higher if we use PET scanning?
I think it's going to be higher. I think the other thing is that as people live longer and longer with their primary tumors, which is what's happening now, for example, patients with breast cancer are living much longer, patients with lung cancer are living somewhat longer, and also patients with all other types of cancers. There's a general trend for all these patients to live longer. I think we're going to find more and more of these patients are going to eventually die or have significant problems secondary to the spread of those cancers to the brain. So we're going to have to pay much more attention to that in the future.
Overall, do you think that because patients are living longer, you know, in our American newspapers, the public's reading that they're going to live to be 100, do you think with that we'll probably end up seeing many more brain tumors just because they're living longer?
I think that brain tumors increase with age. There's no question about that. And the older you are, the more likely you are to develop some particular types of brain tumors. And I think that what we're going to see as people live older is we're going to see more and more cancer in all groups. And in fact, in Canada, it's a significant problem, because when we project out the number of cancers that we're going to see in the next 10 to 20 years, it's an astronomical number because of the number of individuals that were born after the Second World War.
The baby boomers.
And when they come into that age group, the number of these tumors are going to, you know, have an important effect and almost overwhelm the healthcare system.
So what can they take? What can our listeners take home if they have a cancer of their lung, breast, or prostate? Should they just wait for some symptoms that might be affecting their brain, and then they'll get a scan? Or would you say that they should go to their oncologist and recommend a scan?
They can obviously ask and see what happens with that. But brain tumors present in three ways. They can present with rather significant headache, because the brain is encased in a skull, and if you have an extra object in the skull, you'll get substantial headache. The second way they present is increased activity like seizures, and the third way they present is if you have some neurological dysfunction. So if anything like that happens and you happen to have cancer, I think you should see your doctor right away and make absolutely sure that you do not have something that needs further treatment.
Don't go away. We'll be right back with Dr. Rolando Del Maestro. You're listening to How to Save Your Life, and if you want to see how to save your life regarding a tumor in your brain, please stay with us. Welcome back to How to Save Your Life. I'm Dr. Philip Stieg, and I'm talking with Dr. Rolando Del Maestro, a world-renowned neuro-oncologist, William Findell Chair in Neuro-Oncology at the McGill University, and director of the Montreal Neurological Institute's Brain Tumor Research Center. Before we left off, we were talking about how to make sure you were diagnosed with a tumor that might spread to your brain. And now we'll make the assumption that that has happened. And what does the patient do next? As I understand it, there's some controversy about whether they should have surgery, radiation, chemotherapy. You know, how can you help people decide what they should do?
I think the major studies have shown that that if you have only one lesion that we can see on an MR of the brain, that most of those patients are benefited by having that lesion removed surgically. And then the best treatment after that appears to be radiation therapy. The unfortunate part about that is that the whole brain has to be radiated to prevent some of the smaller sort of metastatic lesions that might be there that we can't see on the MR scan.
And by metastatic, we mean?
Spread, ones that have spread. That's right.
Yeah.
So if you see one, there may be some others there, and that's why the radiation is important. Unfortunately, if you have more than one, let's say you have two or three or four, then it becomes a little more complicated. At the present time, there are two ways of dealing with that. The one is that you can have brain radiation to the whole of the brain with the hope that that will control the tumors. Sometimes for certain tumors, for example, for breast, that might be quite useful. Other tumors, like let's say tumors that come from the skin, a tumor called malignant melanoma that can occur from the skin or sometimes from the kidney, are not very sensitive to radiation. So there has been special types of therapy developed, specifically gamma knife, for patients that have more than one or two of these lesions in the brain. And gamma knife appears to be relatively good at preventing these lesions from growing. It doesn't get rid of them completely all the time. You can still see some abnormality on the MR scan, but they certainly get much smaller. And so I've certainly had patients who have been alive for long periods of time who have had one tumor removed from the brain, let's say, and the tumor in the lung has been dealt with, and they are, in essence, cured. And there's a small percentage of patients that are like that, probably 10 or 15% of patients, that even if you have a lesion in the brain and the primary tumor is dealt with, you can live for long periods of time. When you have more than one lesion, sometimes what that means is the tumor has spread to many other parts of your body. And our goal in that situation is to keep the patients as well as we possibly can for as long as we possibly can and not have them have a lot of symptoms related to their brain tumors. So my particular way of dealing with those patients is to treat them individually and to see what the quality of their life is at that point from their original tumor and make the best decisions based on how to deal with the brain tumor. I do not like to have my patients die with metastatic disease and do basically all I can to try to prevent that if at all possible.
The chemotherapy that might be used for a tumor that spreads from the other part of the body is chemotherapy that's usually directed at the primary location, like the lungs. Is that as effective in the brain as it might be in the lungs?
Well, the problem with the brain is that we've developed a very effective way of keeping chemicals that are in our blood from getting into the brain, and that's called the blood-brain barrier. And many of the smaller sort of tumor sort of accumulations that spread to the brain are not going to have a significant breakdown or abnormality in that barrier. So when we give drugs, the common drugs that we give, let's say for lung cancer and some of the other cancers, unfortunately they just don't get by the blood-brain barrier and then they just don't get into the brain. And so that's why, generally speaking, chemotherapy is not very effective. Now there are some tumors, for example, lymphoma is an example, where the drug that we use, which is called methotrexate, gets into the brain very well, is very effective against those tumors, and so high-dose methotrexate can sometimes cause the tumor to completely disappear. And steroids will sometimes do that with lymphoma, too. So there are a number of diseases in which chemotherapy is beneficial, even metastatic disease. But unfortunately, for the vast majority of the typical tumors that people normally think about, we have not developed a chemotherapeutic agent that will get into the brain and deal with the spread of these tumors from other sites in the body.
So I guess the take-home message then is that chemotherapy is an option, but it's not the most common option for these types of lesions, and patients should certainly discuss that with their mm-hmm. local doctors. I would presume one of the great concerns with a patient that has, again, these other primary tumors, and they're functioning pretty well, and all of a sudden they find out that they've got something that's gone into their brain, they start getting quite scared about what their intellectual capabilities and what their quality of life is going to be like. Is that a typical problem with these kinds of lesions, or do they usually go on to have more problems related to their lung cancer?
Many patients that have small sort of areas of the brain that are involved with a secondary tumor, a tumor from someplace else in their body, may have very few symptoms and can live for extended periods of time with very few symptoms. It's only when the tumors get large enough to, irritate important areas of the brain to cause some weakness or to cause problems such as seizures that it's a significant problem. Now, generally now, seizures from these types of tumors can be relatively well controlled, so that's not a big issue. The big issues appear to be if the tumors are in sites that are very difficult to sort of, let's say, remove surgically. And what I'm seeing more and more in some patients is, they have a certain number of tumors in the brain. We deal with those. And then, unfortunately, a year, 2 years later, they can get some more. And we don't have the ability, for example, to use radiation again. Usually, by that time, they've been on a number of different drugs, and they may not be very beneficial. So sometimes these sort of tumors can continue to spread to the brain over a period of years. And in that situation, you're in more difficulty than not.
Is it your experience that patients that have tumors from elsewhere that go to the brain, and if eventually they don't do well and die, is it usually because of the brain problem or because of the lung problem?
It depends on the various tumors that are involved, but in a general sort of way, people think that, let's say, about 30% of these, 30 to 40% of these people will pass away because of their disease involving, let's say, the lung or wherever. Another 30 or 40% will actually succumb because of their brain lesion, and another group, about the same amount, it's a combination of both that ends up causing them to succumb. And so you could say that, I would suspect that brain tumors are involved in the death of these patients in somewhere around 50% if they have a lesion.
Okay. So it's a difficult battle, but as we get better in treating the primary lesions, we're getting better at getting patients to survive from the tumor that's spread.
I think we made substantial progress in that area. The combination of getting these tumors probably a little earlier than we had them before, being much more aware that any patient that has cancer, any place in the body that presents with a problem related to the brain or spinal cord should be seen immediately. And this is important, I think, also in patients that, let's say you have a problem associated with breast cancer or lung cancer and you suddenly develop back pain, you should, make sure that you see your family doctor very, very quickly if you develop substantial back pain. Because if it is from the tumor, then that can usually be treated very easily with just a little bit of radiation. But if the back pain is because the tumor is growing more and more and you don't get appropriate treatment, it can sometimes be very difficult to deal with the problem. The tumors just get too big and they're too difficult to deal with. So, I always say if you've got a patient that has cancer any place in their body and they have night pain in their back, you have to make absolutely sure that it's not because of the tumor.
Yeah. I'd like to change track here a little bit, and I know that much of your life and all of your research has been focusing on tumors that start in the brain. Can you give us a little idea of what type of tumor that is?
Mm. There really are, the brain is made up of neurons, which are sort of the thinking part of the brain, and there are a number of billion of those. Occasionally, neurons can be associated with brain tumors, but relatively rarely. Most of the tumors that occur in the adult brain are related to the fact that we have special cells that sort of take care of the neurons and are involved in their structure or how the brain is built. And those cells under the microscope look like called astrocytes. Under the microscope, they look like they're stars, and that's how they got the name. There's another group of cells that, because the brain is an electrical system, you have to insulate these sort of cavities and channels. And there's another cell called an oligodendroglial cell. It's just a word that means that these are insulating cells. And so young people tend to have these tumors that are more what we call low-grade, involving these two different types of cells. And older people, unfortunately, tend to have tumors that are higher grade. And what that means is that the tumors tend to grow a little bit more quickly and cause more trouble.
Can you clarify that a little bit for us? Yeah, and also touch a little bit upon the word malignant. Here in America, if you use the word malignant, patients start thinking, oh my God, it's going to spread all over my body and all those terrible things. So if you can point out what you mean by low grade, intermediate, high grade.
Well, the difficulty a little bit is that the brain tumors, generally speaking, as I've said before, do not spread to any other part of the body. So in that way, they're not malignant like, for example, a breast cancer or lung cancer may be. But unfortunately, brain tumors have this tendency, at least the tumors that grow more quickly, to invade the brain. And actually, the cells actually move and damage different areas of the brain. And when they do that, they obviously can cause a lot of difficulty for the patient. There are some tumors that tend to stay in the same place all the time. They don't tend to sort of move in different parts of the brain. And we tend to give those tumors the name of benign, or tumors that are clearly not malignant. Some tumors, what we call low-grade tumors, over long periods of time, years and years, will sometimes develop more aggressive characteristics. And they can change, for example, from a more low-grade to a much more high-grade type of tumor. And the higher-grade tumors are malignant because under the microscope, they look like other malignant tumors in the rest of the body. They have lots of cells that are dividing. The cells look very, very abnormal. And they are cells that clearly are not very responsive to any type of therapy.
How do these, I'm walking down the street, how do I know I have one?
Well, I think, you know, the vast majority of people obviously don't have a brain tumor, which is a very good thing. I think there are a couple of signals. I think if a person who is not, you know, usually having headache, suddenly develops headache that is relatively severe in the morning, can sometimes be associated with nausea or vomiting. That's sort of a signal that, you know, something is happening inside that particular person's head. This is the common way that pediatric brain tumors present, and also sometimes in adults. So if, you know, a change in headache pattern is something that one has to look for in both the pediatric or the adult. The other thing that you'll see in children sometimes is that the child will wake up in the morning, have a relatively severe headache, actually vomit because, you know, he feels unwell. After the vomiting, the child will be able to go to school. And that's another sort of very characteristic type of situation that occurs with brain tumors. The second thing is the brain tumors can cause excess electrical activity. So either you can have what we call partial seizures, and these are seizures where people can feel out of touch with reality. They can have abnormal smells, abnormal sort of sensations, have feelings of having been there before and not been there before. We call that déjà vu or jamais vu. And those particular types of problems are sometimes associated with tumors involving specific areas of the brain, temporal lobe, which is an area near your ear, which is involved in that type of activity. And the other way you can sometimes find patients is that, you know, you have, is unlike a stroke, which can give you weakness very quickly or blindness very quickly or something like that, tumors, generally speaking, progress at a relatively slow rate. So one may have, for example, some difficulty with some coordination of an arm or a leg, have difficulty with speech, initially having problems with finding the right word, and eventually this gets worse and worse over time. So those are the three things that one should look for, I think, to worry about. And if you have any of those things, you should obviously see your family doctor and explain the situation to them, and hopefully they'll get on with doing the proper test to make sure that you do not have a problem that can be easily dealt with.
Earlier you mentioned PET scans as a way of screening for tumors that spread from other parts of the body. I'm not suggesting, and I wouldn't want to suggest everybody goes and gets a PET scan at some point in their life, but are there screening tests that are available for patients?
Well, I think the major screening that we do is, let's say you have a tumor that has been found already, And it is a what we would call a low-grade tumor, a tumor that's going to grow very, very slowly. In those particular patients, we tend to do MR scans on a regular basis, either every 6 months or every 12 months, to see whether or not the tumor is coming back and growing. So that may be the best sort of screening that we can do at the present time. Patients that have more malignant brain tumors, let's say who are having radiation or chemotherapy, they also have very standardized ways of having MR scans after the radiation, after the chemotherapy, every sort of 2 or 3 months. And again, that's a screening method to see whether the radiation and chemotherapy are keeping the tumor under control. But for large-scale screening, I remember one study in which about 1,000 people were taken off the street and had MR scans done with no symptoms. There was only one or two of those patients that had anything at all that was abnormal as far as their brain was concerned. So generally speaking, you have to have some symptoms before you can sort of go ahead with these more expensive things. Now, at the Montreal Neurological, we usually use PET scanning to identify, for example, the motor area of the brain or the sensory area, the visual cortex, where the vision comes from in the brain, or some of the intellectual centers and speech. We don't use it very much for screening because, again, it's better for finding function than for finding tumors.
So once a person has either a seizure or weakness on one side or an unusual headache, what kind of tests can they expect to undergo when they see their doctor?
In the past, I think that the screening test that people use was CT scan. That's a relatively simple test that can be done very quickly, 5 or 10 minutes, and relatively easy to get. Nowadays, I think that if you have real symptoms, many people will no longer do a CT scan but go right to what's called an MR scan, which is a very sensitive way of seeing the brain, and is very sensitive for picking up various types of tumors. It's also quite sensitive, for example, for multiple sclerosis and for other types of problems, stroke, etc. So it's probably a better overall test. But CT scanning will show, let's say, 80 or 90% of the lesions quite well. Although most people, before they have an operation, will have an MR scan at this time.
Is that different, say, between Canada and the United States or England and other parts of the world? Are there different value systems?
I think in Canada that we have a socialized sort of medical system, which means that everybody is covered by a government medical system. So if I have a patient, for example, that I think has some symptom, it's very easy in Canada to get, you know, an MR scan done in the next day or two. That's not a particular problem. I think that in some of the testing that we've done, for example, if people have headache that is not associated with any of the things that I talked about, and you do MR scans on them, it's only 1 or 2% of those patients that have anything to be able to find. So in that subgroup of patients, in Canada, you have two options. One option is you can get it privately and get it done. The second option you have is to wait. And generally, in that subgroup of patients, you're going to wait some time. I don't know how long that's going to be. It's getting less. In our province of Ontario, it's down to 25 days now. But the hope is that we can get it down lower and lower as more and more MR scans come on.
It's time to take another short break. Please don't go away. We are with Dr. Rolando Del Maestro, an international expert on the management of brain tumors. And when we get back, you've been diagnosed with a new brain tumor. He's going to tell us what you need to do and how to save your life. Please stay with us. Thank you. Welcome back to How to Save Your Life. I'm Dr. Philip Stieg, and I'm talking with Dr. Rolando Del Maestro, who is the director of the Neuro-Oncology Clinic at the Montreal Neurological Institute and an international expert on the management of brain and spinal cord tumors. Before we left, we were talking about the patient that was diagnosed recently with having a brain tumor. And now I wanted to get into, you know, what do you do? You've gotten this information. Now, who do you seek out, and what are the next steps that you should anticipate?
Well, almost what usually happens when the patient is diagnosed, either diagnosed, let's say, by a CT scan or an MR scan, they're usually referred to a neurosurgeon. The neurosurgeon then has to make a number of decisions in talking with the patients. The decision tree that's involved is, one, does that particular patient have a lesion that needs to be dealt with at this point in time, or can you watch that lesion because it may have been there for a long period of time and may not have been causing a lot of difficulty? In other words, it may have just caused a seizure, may be very small, there may be no other reason to sort of deal with it at this point, and you may just watch it and deal with, you know, whatever the problem happens to be. However, if it's a tumor that looks like it's going to cause problems in the future, then there's a number of options that are available. The one option that's available that is used less and less, I think, now is what's called a biopsy. And what basically happens with a biopsy is a very small hole that's placed in the skull. Using a three-dimensional sort of system, one can place a small needle into the area which is abnormal, take a small little piece of it out, and then make a diagnosis as to what the problem is. So that's one option you have available. The second option you have available would be, for example, to consider what we call a subtotal removal. Let's say the tumor is very close to a very important area of the brain, and you may want to just remove a portion of the tumor and not take any risks, especially if, let's say, it's a tumor that's going to be very low grade and not hurt the patient for many, many years. And the third option is to go for what's called a more aggressive removal, which we tend to do particularly for benign tumors. For example, if you have a tumor that's benign and can be removed completely, that's it. You don't have any problems with it in the future, hopefully. Unfortunately, the vast majority of tumors that start in the brain from these astrocytes that I talked about or these oligodendroglial cells that I talked about, one can't remove every single cell. So if it's, you know, then what the idea is, you know, what do you do, for example, after you do a surgical procedure? And that's something you have to sort of deal with because the options are explained to you. The options may be that, for example, you could consider radiation therapy, you could consider chemotherapy, or you could consider a combination of both. And that's something that you and your family basically have to interact with the neuro-oncologist and the neuro-oncology team and make a decision as to what option you want to choose at that particular point in time. We have knowledge about the results of many of those options, but we don't have clear information about all of them. So sometimes the patient is very important in making their own decisions as to what they would like to have done.
You implied that that needle being passed into the tumor, the biopsy is done less commonly. Does a patient's prognosis vary with, and is it dependent upon how aggressive their surgeon is with resection of a tumor, removal of a tumor?
So this has been a difficult question over time because, generally speaking, for benign tumors, you know, we're talking about tumors like meningiomas, etc., most people would not do a biopsy. They would make an attempt to remove those types of tumors. And most of the real benign tumors, those are tumors that start in one part of the brain, stay in that part of the brain, are not aggressive. If they're removed completely, then the patient is basically cured. So, you know, in some of those patients, you know, 97, 99% of those patients will have a normal life. However, if the tumor happens to be a more aggressive tumor, then, you know, the possibility of removing those tumors is not very likely. The problem with the biopsy is that now with much more information being needed related to the genetics of the tumor, a biopsy gives you a very, very small piece of the tumor. And with that small piece of the tumor, there are a couple of errors that occur. One, sometimes you don't get the right diagnosis. In other words, you may think it's less or more aggressive than it really is because you've got such a small piece. And on average, you may have 1,000th or 100,000th of the tumor. So it's very difficult to make a correct diagnosis sometimes. And second, in many cases, because you have such a small piece of tumor, you can't do any of the genetic studies that appear to be crucial now to determining how well people do. The latest trials that have been done have suggested that especially with malignant brain tumors, that the more the tumor that's removed, the better the patients do in the long run. So surgery is going to have, I think, a much more important role, both to get enough tumor to do all the genetic studies and also to remove as much tumor as one can safely, and then also possibly to put part of that tumor in a tumor bank so that as new drugs come along, if that particular tumor has the genetics that would respond to that new drug, then that particular new drug could be used in that patient. So I think that brain tumor banking and tumor banking in general is going to be much more important in the future than it is now.
After you also implied that after they get the tumor removed, either partially or totally, they're going to get some other treatment, and one of those things was radiation. Mm. Is radiation the same now as it was 10 years ago? And if not, how is it different?
Well, what basically was happening 10 years ago is that, you know, they were using systems to radiate the brain that were really from the front and the back of the brain. And the brain actually got a substantial amount of radiation in many different areas, far distant from where the tumor actually was. And some of those patients didn't do very well with the radiation therapy. They developed newer models of radiation therapy, particularly what's called conformal radiation. And in that system, what happens is that a number of computers are used to sort of model where the tumor was and to radiate only about 2 centimeters, about half an inch or so, away from where the tumor was to begin with. And that type of radiation has resulted in much less difficulty from the intellectual point of view and from long-term complications point of view. The radiation is certainly not a type of therapy that has no complications, because every type of therapy has a complication, but they're working hard to try to make it better.
Are there other things besides radiation that a patient should be asking about that they'd either want to do in series or simultaneously with the radiation?
The biggest improvement that has occurred in the treatment of malignant brain tumors, we're talking about the most malignant brain tumors that occur in humans related to the brain, is adding the chemotherapy and the radiation at the same time. And it's what's called the Stupp protocol, which in essence means that you take a drug every day during the radiation therapy, and then that's usually about a 6-week course. And then after the you finish the radiation, once a month, you're given the drug by mouth. And this particular drug is called Temodal in Canada, called Temodar here. And it's made a substantial improvement in survival. Survival's going, for example, from 10% to 25-26% at 2 years. And some of those survivals seem to be long-standing. So it's the major advance that we've had over the last 20 or 30 years.
So they should be looking for this here in the States, the Temodar. Do they need to be frightened? I think people have a picture in their mind with chemotherapy of hair loss, pale looking and that. Is that different with this drug?
This drug's an amazing drug in the sense that you take it by mouth, and it's not given intravenously. Most patients take it very easily with very few side effects. They can work, they can go to school with it, and you take it in the present sort of form, you take it 5 days out of every 28. So the vast majority of patients are able to tolerate this drug very easily. It's almost a revolution as far as chemotherapy is concerned, because it's so easy to take for the vast majority of patients.
So that sounds like hopeful and great news for people.
I think the next 5 or 10 years, as far as brain tumors and cancer in general, is going to be very hopeful. My belief is with the new information that we have about the way tumors are formed, the importance of some genetic changes, their ability to find those genetic changes and actually hit them with drugs specifically targeted to sort of improve or change that genetic change, we're going to see a substantial improvement in survival. That's beginning to happen in breast. It's beginning to even happen in lung. And it's also beginning to happen in brain-related tumors. So I think the day is going to come when, you know, we're going to take a small amount of the tumor out, let's say. We'll be able to identify exactly what that particular tumor's genetic abnormalities are. And then we'll have a whole shelf of different drugs based on specific genetic abnormalities, and treat the patient appropriately with the drug that is specific for their individual tumor. So I think the idea in the future is really individualization of tumor. Every tumor is probably a little different. So every human tumor is probably unique. And we're going to have to get involved in that uniqueness. You're unique as an individual, and probably your tumor is a bit unique too. So if we can find the uniqueness of that tumor and unique sort of Achilles heel of that tumor or the weakness of that tumor has and attack that, then I think we're going to do much, much better. And that's where all the research is going at the present time.
So I'm curious, you know, looking through your background, you went to school in London, Ontario, then you did your PhD in Uppsala, Sweden, now you're in Montreal. How'd you get into medicine?
Well, what basically happened was I was actually born in Italy, and after the Second World War, and that particular time period was a time period where, things weren't very well. And my father, despite the fact that he had two jobs, was not able to make enough money to sort of keep the family sort of going. So he decided to move to Canada, along with a number of other people from the village I was born in. What was interesting was that we didn't have enough money for myself and my mother and my father to go. So my father borrowed the money for him to go, but my mother and I were sort of kept as collateral until that debt was paid off. And so when that debt was paid off, my mother and I were able to go to Canada and meet with my father, and that was about a year later. So I sort of grew up in sort of a family in which education was considered to be important, and also grew up in a family where, you know, my mother was listening to, despite the fact that she didn't have very much in the truth. She went to grade 5, my father went to grade 3, but she loved opera, so my whole growing up was listening to opera on the phonograph. And so, and also she was very, very interested in art, again, despite the fact that she hadn't had much exposure to art, she was really, really involved in it. So she decided that what had to happen in our family, which was myself and my brother, was that one of us were going to be a doctor and the other one's going to be a dentist. And that way there would be no problems in the future about feeding their families and whether a war came along or not. And so I guess I was the one that was the decision was made that I was going to be the physician of the two. I was the older of the two, so I guess that was what happened. But I think I got from her and my father the idea of, you know, working hard and being caring about other people. And from that, being a physician was a sort of a natural sort of extension.
Do you think that background kind of directed you towards the field of neurosurgery that you picked in terms of brain tumors?
When I went into doing my undergraduate work, what was interesting to me was two things. One, I was quite interested in humans per se, the whole idea of people and their various diseases and things. And then what you have to do when you consider going to medicine is, you know, am I going to be a surgeon or am I going to go into medicine, the medical part of medicine? And when you become a surgeon, what you basically have to do is you have to make decisions, and those decisions are difficult decisions because you have to make a decision that you're going to sort of, you know, do an operation, cut this particular patient's scalp and operate on this particular patient's brain. You know, to me at that time, the brain was the most interesting organ in the body, and the reason is because it's the most complex object that I know in the universe, and it's such a marvelous object. It not only can interpret what you feel and what you hear, etc., but it also allows you to have feelings of love and emotion and all those types of things. And so it seemed sort of reasonable that I, if I was going to be in medicine and going to be interested in surgery, that I'd be interested in this organ that was such an important organ as far as humans were concerned. And therefore, that's how I got into neurosurgery. Now, when I went into neurosurgery, and this was in the early 80s, the vast majority of patients with brain tumors did not do very well. And the prognosis had not changed for many, many, many years. And therefore, it was an area that not a lot of people were very interested in. I guess because of the fact that I felt that there was still a possibility that if one worked hard and one did the research, etc., that we'd be able to make substantial improvements. In one way, it was a bit of a challenge to me. But at the same time, my wife and I started what was called the Brain Tumor Foundation of Canada to help patients and support groups, raise money for research. My wife in particular got very involved in the North American Brain Tumor Coalition. She was the president for a number of years. She's presently a co-chairperson, trying to improve the money that was allocated to brain tumor research by both Canada and the United States. And we've had a very interesting life, the two of us. We were just in China together a couple of weeks ago, again, trying to sort of see the types of things that we could do to help patients in that sort of environment.
So I think from my point of view, I think I've always been interested in helping people, I guess. And I've always been interested in complex problems. And the brain is a pretty complex area. And brain tumors have to be one of the more complicated types of tumors that we deal with. And it's a challenge.
Well, it seems like, just in listening to you, that you're an optimistic person. But I also got the sense from your earlier conversation that you're hopeful and very optimistic about our future with brain tumors.
I'm a strong believer at the present time. The next 5 or 10 years, we're going to see substantial improvement in cancer therapy. And I'm very, very hopeful. And if we can keep some of our patients alive and going to the day when we get more understanding about these genetic causes of brain tumors and how to deal with them, I think we're going to see a renaissance in this whole area. And I always tell people that my hope is that this will put me out of work, that eventually we'll be able to treat these tumors very, very simply with the appropriate sort of chemotherapy based on the genetics of the tumor, and I won't have to be sort of doing operations anymore. So hopefully the future will be much brighter than the past has been. And I have no problems at all with the belief that the future is right in front of us. We just have to reach out, do the research, get the funds for the research, and with our patients' help and other people's help, we'll beat this disease.
Well, Dr. Rolando Del Maestro, thank you so much for taking this time to be on How to Save Your Life. Dr. Del Maestro is the William Findell Chair in Neuro-Oncology at McGill University, Montreal Neurological Institute. It's been an honor and a pleasure having you on the show.
Thank you very much.
Dr. Philip Stieg is the Chairman of the Department of Neurological Surgery at Weill Cornell Medical College and Neurosurgeon-in-Chief at New York Presbyterian Hospital. Joe Woodruff is our producer. The executive producer is Alan Chartok. Our audio engineer is Adam Claremont. Production support for How to Save Your Life comes from the Department of Neurological Surgery, Weill Cornell Medical College, New York Presbyterian Hospital. How to Save Your Life is a presentation of National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content.